Chapter 41 Ralph's posters announcing the August 18th meeting went up all over Boulder. There was a great deal of excited conversation, most of it having to do with the good and bad qualities of the 7-person ad hoc committee. Mother Abigail went to bed exhausted before the light was even gone from the sky. The day had been a steady stream of callers, all of them wanting to know what her opinion was. She allowed as how she thought most of the choices for the committee were pretty good. The people who came to call were anxious to know if she would serve on a more permanent committee, if one should be formed at the big meeting. She replied that that would be a spot too tiring, but she sure would give a committee of elected representatives whatever help she could, if people wanted her to help out. She was assured again and again that any permanent committee that refused her help would be turned out en masse, and that right early. Mother Abigail went to bed tired but satisfied. So did Nick Andrews that night. In one day, by virtue of a single poster turned out on a hand-crank mimeograph machine, the Free Zone had been transformed from a loose group of refugees into potential voters. They liked it. It gave them the sense of a place to stand after a long period of free fall. That afternoon, Ralph drove him out to the power plant. He, Ralph, and Stu agreed to hold a preliminary meeting at Stu and Franny's place the day after next. It would give all 7 of them another 2 days to listen to what people were saying. Nick smiled and cupped his own useless ears. "Lip reading's even better," Stu said. "You know, Nick, I'm starting to think we're really going to get somewhere with those blown motors. That Brad Kitchener's a regular bear for work. If we had 10 like him, we'd have this whole town running perfect by the 1st of September." Nick gave him a thumb and forefinger circle, and they walked inside together. That afternoon, Larry Underwood and Leo Rockway walked west on Arapahoe Street toward Harold's house. Larry was wearing the knapsack he had worn all the way across the country, but all that was in it now was the bottle of wine and 6 paydays. Lucy was out with a party of 6 people who were beginning on their own to clear the streets and roads in and around Boulder of stalled vehicles. Trouble was, it was a sporadic operation that only ran when a few people felt like getting together and doing it. A wrecking bee instead of a quilting bee, Larry thought, and his eye caught one of the posters headed Mass Meeting, this one nailed to a telephone pole. Maybe that would be the answer. Hell, people around here wanted to work. What they needed was somebody to coordinate things and tell them what to do. A tinkle of glass made him turn. Leo had lobbed a large stone from someone's rock garden through the rear window of an old Ford. A bumper sticker on the back deck of the Ford's trunk read, "Get your ass up the pass, Cold Creek Canyon." "Don't do that, Joe. I'm Leo." "Leo," he corrected, "don't do that." "Why not?" Leo asked complacently. And for a long time, Larry couldn't think of a satisfactory answer. "Because it makes an ugly sound," he said finally. "Okay." They walked on. Larry put his hands in his pockets. Leo did likewise. Larry kicked a beer can. Leo swerved out of his way to kick a stone. Larry began to whistle a tune. Leo made a whispering, chuffing sound in accompaniment. Larry ruffled the kid's hair, and Leo looked up at him with those odd Chinese eyes and grinned. And Larry thought, "For Christ's sake, I'm falling in love with him. Pretty far out." They came to the park Franny had mentioned, and across from it was a greenhouse with white shutters. There was a wheelbarrow full of bricks on the cement path leading up to the front door, and next to it was a garbage can lid filled with that do-it-yourself mortar mix to which you just add water. Squatting beside it, his back to the street, was a broad-shouldered guy with a shirt off and the peeling remnants of a bad sunburn. He had a trowel in one hand. He was building a low and curving brick wall around a flower bed. Larry thought of Fran saying, "He's changed. I don't know how or why, or even if it's for the best. And sometimes I'm afraid." Then he stepped forward, saying it just the way he had planned on his long days crossing the country. "Harold Lauder, I presume?" Harold jerked with surprise, then turned with a brick in one hand and his mortar-dripping trowel in the other, half-raised, like a weapon. Out of the corner of his eye, Larry thought he saw Leo flinch backward. His first thought was, sure enough, Harold didn't look at all as he had imagined. His second thought had to do with the trowel. My God, is he going to let me have it with that thing? Harold's face was grimly set, his eyes narrow and dark. His hair fell in a lank wave across his sweaty forehead. His lips were pressed together and almost white. And then there was a transformation so sudden and complete that Larry was never quite able to believe afterward that he had seen that tense, unsmiling Harold, the face of a man more apt to use a trowel to wall someone up in a basement niche than to construct a garden wall. He smiled, a broad and harmless grin that made deep dimples at the corners of his mouth. His eyes lost their menacing cast. He stuck the trowel blade down into the mortar, chunk, wiped his hands on the hips of his jeans, and advanced with his hand out. Larry thought, my God, he's just a kid, younger than I am. If he's 18 yet, I'll eat the candles on his last birthday cake. Don't think I know you, Harold said, grinning as they shook. He had a firm grip, and Larry's hand was pumped up and down exactly 3 times and let go. It reminded Larry of the time he had shaken hands with Henry Scoop Jackson back when Jackson had been running for president. It had been at a political rally, which he had attended on the advice of his mother, given many years ago. If you can't afford a movie, go to the zoo. If you can't afford the zoo, go see a politician. But Harold's grin was contagious, and Larry grinned back. Kid or not, politician's handshake or not, the grin impressed him as completely genuine. And after all this time, after all those candy wrappers, here was Harold Lauder in the flesh. No, you don't, Larry said, but I'm acquainted with you. Is that so? Harold exclaimed, and his grin escalated. If it got any broader, Larry thought with amusement, the ends would meet around at the back of his skull, and the top 2/3 of his head would just topple off. I followed you across the country from Maine, Larry said. No fooling, you did, really. Really did, he unslung his pack. Here, I've got some stuff for you. He took out the bottle of Bordeaux and put it in Harold's hand. Say, you shouldn't have, Harold said, looking at the bottle with some astonishment. 1947? A good year, Larry said. And these? He put nearly half a dozen paydays in Harold's other hand. One of them slipped through his fingers and onto the grass. Harold bent to pick it up, and as he did, Larry caught a glimpse of that earlier expression. Then Harold bobbed back up, smiling. How did you know? I followed your signs and your candy wrappers. Well, I'd be go to hell. Come on in the house. We ought to have a jaw, as my dad was fond of saying. Would your boy drink a Coke? Sure, wouldn't you, Leo? He looked around, but Leo was no longer beside him. He was all the way back on the sidewalk and looking down at some cracks in the pavement as if they were of great interest to him. Hey, Leo, want a Coke? Leo muttered something Larry couldn't hear. Talk up, he said, irritated. What did God give you a voice for? I asked you if you wanted a Coke. Barely audible, Leo said, I think I'll go see if Nadine Mom's back. What the hell? We just got here. I want to go back, Leo said, looking up from the cement. The sun flashed too strongly back from his eyes, and Larry thought, what in God's name is this? He's almost crying. Just a sec, he said to Harold. Sure, Harold said, grinning. Sometimes kids are shy. I was. Larry walked over to Leo and hunkered down so they would be at eye level. What's the matter, kiddo? I just want to go back, Leo said, not meeting his gaze. I want Nadine, Mom. Well, you... He paused helplessly. Want to go back? He looked up briefly at Larry. His eyes flickered over Larry's shoulder toward where Harold stood in the middle of his lawn. Then down at the cement again. Please. You don't like Harold? I don't know. He's all right. I just want to go back. Larry sighed. Can you find your way? Sure. Okay, but I sure wish you'd come in and have a Coke with us. I've been waiting to meet Harold a long time. You know that, don't you? Yes. And we could walk back together. I'm not going in that house, Leo hissed. And for a moment he was Joe again, the eyes going blank and savage. Okay, Larry said hastily. He stood up. Go straight home. I'll check to see if you did, and stay out of the street. I will. And suddenly Leo blurted in that small, hissing whisper, "Why don't you come back with me right now? We'll go together. Please, Larry, okay?" "Geez, Leo, what?" "Never mind," Leo said. And before Larry could say anything more, Leo was hurrying away. Larry stood watching him until he was out of sight. Then he turned back to Harold with a troubled frown. "Say, that's all right," Harold said. "Kids are funny." "I guess he's got a right. He's been through a lot." "I'll bet he has," Harold replied. And for just an instant, Larry felt distrust, felt that Harold's quick sympathy for a boy he had never met was as ersatz as powdered eggs. "Well, come in," Harold said. "You know, you're just about my first company. Franny and Stu have been out a few times, but they hardly count." His grin became a smile, a slightly sad smile, and Larry felt sudden pity for this boy, because a boy was all he was, really. He was lonely, and here stood Larry, same old Larry, never a good word for anyone. "Glad to," he answered. The living room was small but comfortable. "I'm going to put in some new furniture when I get around to it," Harold said. "Modern, chrome and leather. As the commercial says, fuck the budget, I've got master charge." Larry laughed heartily. "There's some good glasses in the basement. I'll just get them. Try that green chair. It's the best of a bad lot." Harold left, and Larry sat down in the green chair. He heard a door open, and then Harold's heavy tread descending a flight of stairs. He looked around. Nope, not one of the world's great living rooms, but with a shag rug and some nice modern furniture, it could be fine. The best feature of this room was the stone fireplace and chimney. Lovely work, carefully done by hand. But there was one loose stone on the hearth. It looked to Larry as if it had come out and had been put back a little carelessly. Leaving it like that would be like leaving one piece out of the jigsaw puzzle or a picture hanging crooked on the wall. He got up and picked the stone out of the hearth. Harold was still rummaging around downstairs. Larry was about to put it back in when he saw there was a book down in the hole, its front now lightly powdered with rock dust, not enough to obscure the single word stamped there in gold leaf. Ledger. Feeling slightly ashamed, as if he had been prying intentionally, he put the rock back in just as Harold's footfalls began to ascend the stairs again. This time the fit was perfect, and when Harold came back into the living room with a balloon glass in each hand, Larry was seated in the green chair again. "I took a minute to rinse them out in the downstairs sink," Harold said. "They were a bit dusty." "They look fine," Larry said. "Look, I can't swear that Bordeaux hasn't gone over. We might be helping ourselves to vinegar." "Nothing ventured," Harold said, grinning. "Nothing gained." That grin made him feel uncomfortable. And Larry suddenly found himself thinking about the ledger. Was it Harold's, or had it belonged to the house's previous owner? And if it was Harold's, what in the world might be written in there? They cracked the bottle of Bordeaux and found, to their mutual pleasure, that it was just fine. Half an hour later, they were both pleasantly squiffed, Harold a little more so than Larry. Even so, Harold's grin remained, broadened, in fact. His tongue loosened a bit by wine, Larry said. "Those posters, the big meeting on the 18th. How come you didn't get on that committee, Harold? I would have thought that a guy like you would have been a natural." Harold's smile became large, beatific. "Well, I'm awfully young. I suppose they thought I didn't have experience enough." "I think it's a goddamn shame." But did he? The grin, the dark, barely glimpsed expression of suspicion? Did he? He didn't know. "Well, who knows what lies in the future," Harold said, grinning broadly. "Every dog has its day." Larry left around 5 o'clock. His parting from Harold was friendly. Harold shook his hand, grinned, and told him to come back often. But Larry had somehow gotten the feeling that Harold could give a shit if he never came back. He walked slowly down the cement path to the sidewalk and turned to wave, but Harold had already gone back inside. The door was shut. It had been very cool in the house because the Venetian blinds were drawn, and inside that had seemed all right. But standing outside, it occurred to him suddenly that it was the only house he'd been inside in Boulder where the blinds and curtains were drawn. But of course he thought there were still plenty of houses in Boulder where the shades were drawn. They were the houses of the dead. When they got sick, they had drawn their curtains against the world. They had drawn them and died in privacy, like any animal in its last extremity, prefers to do. The living, maybe in subconscious acknowledgement of that fact of death, threw their curtains wide. Thank God for tunnel vision, he thought. Thank God for selective perception, because without it we might as well all be in a Lovecraft story. His thoughts became confused. He suddenly became convinced that Harold was peering at him from between the slats of his blinds, his hands opening and closing in a strangler's grip, his grin turned into a leer of hatred. Every dog has its day. Stop it. Stop freaking yourself out. Boot Hill, his mind free associated. Christ's sake, just stop it. Wish I'd never thought about the dead people. The dead people behind all those closed blinds and pulled drapes and shut curtains in the dark, like in the tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel. Christ, what if they all started to move, to stir around? Holy God, cut it out. Larry, are you okay? He was so startled that a little noise, yike, squeaked out of his throat and he jumped. It was Leo, sitting on the curb about 3 blocks down from Harold's. He had a ping-pong ball and was bouncing it up and down on the pavement. What are you doing here? Larry asked. I wanted to walk home with you, Leo said diffidently, but I didn't want to go into that guy's house. Why not? Larry asked. He sat down on the curb beside Leo. Leo shrugged and turned his eyes back to the ping-pong ball. It made a small whack, whack sound as it struck the pavement and bounced back up to his hand. I don't know. Leo? What? This is very important to me, because I like Harold and don't like him. I feel two ways about him. Have you ever felt two ways about a person? I only feel one way about him. Quack, quack. How? Scared, Leo said simply. Can we go home and see my Nadine mom and my Lucy mom? Sure. They continued down Arapaho for a while without speaking, Leo still bouncing the ping-pong ball and catching it deftly. Sorry you had to wait so long, Larry said. Oh, that's okay. No, really, if I'd known, I would have hurried up. I had something to do. I found this on a guy's lawn. It's a pong-ping ball. Ping-pong, Larry corrected absently. Why do you think Harold would keep his shades down? So nobody can see in, I guess, Leo said. So he can do secret things. It's like the dead people, isn't it? Whack, whack. They walked on, reached the corner of Broadway, and turned south. They saw other people on the streets now. Women looking in windows at dresses. A man with a pickaxe returning from somewhere. Another man casually sorting through fishing tackle in the broken display window of a sporting goods store. Secret things, Larry mused aloud, not really trying to draw the boy out anymore. Maybe he's praying to the dark man, Leo said casually, and Larry jerked as if brushed by a live wire. Leo didn't notice. He was double bouncing his ping-pong ball, first off the sidewalk, and then catching it on the rebound from the brick wall they were passing. Whack-whap. You really think so? Larry asked, making an effort to sound casual. I don't know, but he's not like us. He smiles a lot, but I think there might be worms inside him making him smile. Big white worms eating up his brain like maggots. Leo. Leo's eyes, dark, remote, and Chinese, suddenly cleared. He smiled. Look, there's Dana. I like her. Hey, Dana, he yelled, waving. Got any gum? Dana, who'd been oiling the sprocket of a spidery thin 10-speed bike, turned and smiled. She reached into her shirt pocket and spread out 5 sticks of juicy fruit like a poker hand. With a happy laugh, Leo ran toward her, his long hair flying, ping-pong ball clutched in one hand, leaving Larry to stare after him. That idea of white worms behind Harold's smile. Where had Joe... No, Leo, he's Leo, at least I think he is. Gotten an idea as sophisticated and as horrible as that. The boy had been in a semi-trance. And he wasn't the only one. How many times in the few days he had been here had Larry seen someone just stop dead on the street, looking blankly at nothing for a moment, and then going on? Things had changed. The whole range of human perception seemed to have stepped up a notch. It was scary as hell, Larry got his feet moving and walked over to where Leo and Dana were sharing out the chewing gum. That afternoon, Stu found Franny washing clothes in the small yard behind their building. She had filled a low wash tub with water, had shaken in nearly half a box of Tide, and had stirred everything with a mop handle until a sickly suds had resulted. She doubted if she was going about this in the right way, but she was damned if she was going to go to Mother Abigail and expose her ignorance. She dumped their clothes into the water, which was stone cold, then grimly jumped in and began to stomp and slosh around, like a Sicilian mashing grapes. "Your new model Maytag 5000, she thought. "The double-foot agitation method, perfect for all your bright colors, fragile underthings, and..." She turned around and beheld her man standing just inside the backyard gate and watching her with an expression of amusement. Franny stopped, a little out of breath. "Ha-ha, very funny. How long have you been there, Smarty Pants?" "Couple of minutes. What do you call that, anyway? The mating dance of the wild wood duck?" Again, ha-ha. She looked coolly at him. "One more crack and you can spend the night on the couch or up on Flagstaff with your friend Glenn Bateman." "Say, I didn't mean..." "They're your clothes, too, Mr. Stuart Redman. You may be a founding father and all that, but you still leave an occasional skid mark in your underdrawers." Stu grinned. The grin broadened, and finally he had to laugh. "That's crude, darling. Right now I don't feel particularly delicate. We'll pop out for a minute. I need to talk to you." She was glad to, even though she would have to wash her feet before getting back in. Her heart was hurrying along, not happily, but rather dolefully, like a faithful piece of machinery being misused by someone with a marked lack of good sense. "When my wife hand washed," Stu said, "she used a, what do you call it, a scrub board, I think. My mother had about three, I remember." "I know that," Franny said, irritated. "June Brinkmeyer and I walked over half of Boulder looking for one. We couldn't find a single one. Technology strikes again." He was smiling again. Franny put her hands on her hips. "Are you trying to piss me off, Stuart Redman?" "No'm. I was just thinking I know where I can get you a scrub board, I think. Junie, too, if she wants one." "Where? You let me look and see first." His smile disappeared, and he put his arms around her and his forehead on hers. "You know I appreciate you washing my clothes," he said. "And I know that a woman who is pregnant knows better than her man what she should and shouldn't be doing. But, Franny, why bother?"
"Why?"
She looked at him, perplexed.
"Well, what are you going to wear? Do you want to go around in dirty clothes?"
"Franny, the stores are full of clothes, and I'm an easy size."
"What, throw out the old ones just because they're dirty?"
He shrugged a little uneasily.
"No way, uh-uh," she said. "That's the old way, Stu. Like the boxes they used to put your Big Mac in, or the no-deposit, no-return bottles. That's no way to start over."
He gave her a little kiss.
"All right, only next wash day it's my turn, you hear?"
"Sure." She smiled a little shyly. "And how long does that last, until I deliver?"
"Until we get the power back on," Stu said. "Then I'm going to bring you the biggest, shiniest washer you ever saw and hook it up myself."
Offer accepted. She kissed him firmly, and he kissed back, his strong hands moving restlessly in her hair. The result was a spreading warmth. Hotness, let's not be coy. I'm hot, and he always gets me hot when he does that. That first piqued her nipples, then spread down into her lower belly. "You better stop," she said rather breathlessly, "unless you plan to do more than talk."
"Maybe we'll talk later."
"The clothes, soaking's good for that grimed in dirt," he said seriously. She started to laugh, and he stopped her mouth with a kiss. As he lifted her, set her on her feet, and led her inside, she was struck by the warmth of the sun on her shoulders and wondered, "Was it ever so hot before, so strong? It's cleared up every last blemish on my back. Could it be the ultraviolet, I wonder, or the altitude? Is it this way every summer? Is it this hot?" And then he was doing things to her. Even on the stairs he was doing things to her, making her naked, making her hot, making her love him.
"No, you sit down," he said.
"But I mean it, Franny."
Stuart, they'll congeal or something. I put half a box of Tide in there. Don't worry. So she sat down in the lawn chair in the building's shady overhang. He had set up two of them when they came back down. Sue took off his shoes and socks and rolled up his pants past the knee. As he stepped into the washtub and began gravely to stomp up and down on the clothes, she began to giggle helplessly. Stu looked over and said, "You want to spend the night on the couch?" "No, Stuart," she said with grave repentance, and then began to giggle again, until tears ran down her cheeks and the little muscles in her stomach felt rubbery and weak. When she had some control again, she said, "For the third and last time, what did you come back to talk about?" "Oh, yeah." He marched back and forth, and by now he had worked up quite a bed of lather. A pair of blue jeans floated to the surface, and he stomped them back down, sending a creamy squirt of soap suds onto the lawn. Franny thought, "It looks a little like..." "Oh, no, away with that, away with that, unless you want to laugh yourself into a miscarriage." "We've got that first ad hoc meeting tonight," Stu said. "I've got two cases of beer, cheese crackers, cheese spread, some pepperoni that should still be..." "That's not it, Franny. Dick Ellis came by today and said he wanted off the committee." "He did?" She was surprised. "He said he'd be glad to serve in any capacity as soon as we got ourselves a real doctor, but just now he can't. We had another 25 come in today, and one of them had a gangrenous leg. Came from a scratch she got crawling under a rusty barbed wire fence, apparently." "Oh, that's bad." "Dick saved her. Dick and that nurse that came in with Underwood. Tall, pretty girl. Laurie Constable, her name is. Dick said he just would have lost the woman without her. Anyway, they took her leg off at the knee, and they're both exhausted. It took them 3 hours. Plus, they've got a little boy with convulsive fits, and Dick's driving himself crazy trying to figure out if it's epilepsy or cranial pressure of some kind, or maybe diabetes. They've had several cases of food poisoning from people eating stuff that's gone over, and he says some people are going to die of it if we don't get out a flyer real soon telling people how to pick their supplies. Lucky for us, this Laurie Constable seems sort of stuck on him, even though he's about twice her age. I guess that's all right." "How big of you to give them your seal of approval, Stuart?" He smiled. "Anyhow, Dick's 48 and he's got a minor heart condition. Right now, he feels that he can't spread himself too thin. He's practically studying to be a doctor, for the Lord's sake." He looked soberly at Fran. "I can understand how that Laurie feels. He's the closest thing to a hero we've got around here. He's just a country vet, and he's scared shitless he's going to kill someone. And he knows there are more people coming in every day, and some of them have been banged around. So we need one more for the committee." "Yeah, Ralph Brentner's gung-ho for this Larry Underwood guy, and from what you say, he struck you as being pretty handy." "Yes, he did. I think he'd be fine. And I met his lady today downtown, Lucy Swan, her name is. She's awfully sweet, and she thinks the world of Larry." "I guess every good woman feels that way. But, Franny, I gotta be honest with you. I don't like the way he spilled his life story to someone he just met." "I think it was just because I was with Harold from the start. I don't think he understood why I was with you instead of him." "I wonder what he made of Harold. Ask him and see. I guess I will." "Are you going to invite him onto the committee?" "More likely than not." He stood up. "I'd like to have that old fellow they call the judge. But he's 70, that's too damn old." "Have you talked to him about Larry?" "No, but Nick did. Nick Andros is one sharp guy, Fran. He changed a few things around on Glenn and I. Glenn was a little bent out of shape about it, but even he had to admit Nick's ideas were good ones. Anyway, the judge told Nick that Larry's just the kind of person we're looking for. He said Larry was just getting around to finding out he was good for something and that he was going to get a lot better." "I'd call that a pretty strong recommendation." "Yes," Stu said. "But I'm going to find out what he thought of Harold before I invite him along for the ride." "What is it about Harold?" she asked restlessly. "He never says a mean word against you, Stu, or anybody." "No," Stu agreed. "He smiles. That's what I don't like." "You don't think he's plotting revenge or anything?" Stu smiled and stood up. "No, not Harold. Glenn thinks the opposition party may just end up coming together around Harold. That's okay. I just hope he doesn't try to fuck up what we're doing now." "He may be feeling rejected," I think he expected to be on the ad hoc committee. That was one of Nick's unilateral, decisions that we all went along with. What it came down to was that none of us quite trusted him. In a gun quit, she said, he was the most insufferable kid you could imagine. But after the flu, he seemed to change. At least to me, he did. He seemed to be trying to be, well, a man. Then he changed again, like all at once. He started to smile all the time. You couldn't really talk to him anymore. He was in himself, the way people get when they convert to religion or read. She stopped suddenly, and her eyes took on a momentary, startled look that seemed very like fear. Read what? Stu asked. Something that changes their lives, she said. Das Kapital, Mein Kampf, or maybe just intercepted love letters. Fran, are you okay? I'm fine, she smiled, but it looked artificial, like Harold's smile. What did I think of him? Larry asked. He and Stu were in the living room of a small Table Mesa tract house. Out in the kitchen, Lucy was rattling dinner together, heating canned stuff on a brazier grill Larry had rigged for her. It ran off bottled gas. She was singing snatches of honky-tonk women as she worked, and she sounded very happy. Stu nodded and lit a cigarette. He was down to no more than 5 or 6 a day. He didn't fancy having Dick Ellis operating on him for lung cancer. Well, all the time I was following Harold, I kept telling myself he probably wouldn't be like I pictured him. And he wasn't, but I'm still trying to figure out what it is about him. He was pleasant as hell, a good host. He cracked the bottle of wine I brought him, and we toasted each other's good health. I had a good time, but we came up behind him, Leo and me. He was putting up a brick wall around his flower garden, and he whirled around. Didn't hear us coming until I spoke up, I guess. And for a minute there, I'm saying to myself, holy God, this dude is going to kill me. Lucy came into the doorway. Stu, can you stay for dinner? There's plenty. Thanks, but Franny expects me back. I can only stay 15 minutes or so. Sure? Next time, Lucy, thanks. Okay. She went back into the kitchen. Did you come just to ask about Harold? Larry asked. No, Stu said, coming to a decision. I came to ask if you'd serve on our little ad hoc committee. Dick Ellis had to say no. Like that, is it? Larry went to the window and looked out on the silent street. I thought I could go back to being a private again. Your decision, of course. We need one more. You were recommended. By who, if you don't mind me? We asked around. Franny seems to think you're pretty level. And Nick Andros talked. Well, he doesn't talk, but you know, to one of the men that came in with you, Judge Ferris. Larry looked pleased. The judge gave me a recommendation, huh? Well, that's great. You know, you ought to have him. He's smart as the devil. That's what Nick said, but he's also 70, and our medical facilities are pretty primitive. Larry turned to look at Stu, half smiling. This committee isn't quite as temporary as it looks on the face of it, is it? Well, let's put it this way. We'd like to see our committee stand for election to a full term. Preferably unopposed, Larry said. His eyes on Stu were friendly, but sharp. Very sharp. Stu relaxed a little. Regardless of how he himself felt about Larry Underwood, he still wasn't sure. He could agree with Fran and the judge about one thing. The boy hadn't fallen off a hay truck yesterday. Can I get you a beer? I better not. Had a few too many with Glenn Bateman a couple of nights ago. Fran's a patient girl, but her patience only stretches so far. What do you say, Larry? Want to ride along? I guess. Oh, hell, I say yes. I thought nothing in the world would make me happier than to get here and dump my people and let somebody else take over for a change. Instead, pardon my French, I've been just about bored out of my tits. We're having a little meeting tonight at my place to talk over the big meeting on the 18th. Think you could come? Sure, can I bring Lucy? Stu shook his head slowly. Nor talk to her about it. We want to keep some of this stuff close for a while. Larry's smile evaporated. I'm not much on cloak and dagger, Stu. I better get that up front because it might save a hassle later. I think what happened in June happened because too many people were playing it a little too close. That wasn't any act of God. That was an act of pure human fuckery. That's one you don't want to get into with the mother, Stu said. He was still smiling, relaxed. As it happens, I agree with you. But would you feel the same way if it was wartime? I don't follow you. That man we dreamed about. I doubt if he's just gone away. Larry looked startled, considering. Glenn says he can understand why nobody's talking about that, Stu went on. Even though we've all been warned, the people here are still shell-shocked. They feel like they've been through hell to get here. All they want to do is lick their wounds and bury their dead. But if Mother Abigail's here, then he's there, Stu said. He jerked his head toward the window, which gave on a view of the Flatirons rising in the high summer haze. And most of the people here may not be thinking about him, but I'd bet my bottom dollar that he's thinking about us. Larry glanced at the doorway to the kitchen, but Lucy had gone outside to talk to Jane Hovington from next door. That's a nice thought to have just before dinner, he said to Stu in a low voice. Good for the appetite. Mother Abigail says it won't be over one way or the other until he's got us or we've got him. I hope she's not saying that around. These people would be heading for fucking Australia. Thought you didn't hold much with secrets. Yeah, but this... Larry stopped. Stu was smiling kindly, and Larry smiled back rather sourly. Okay, your point. We talk it out and keep our mouths shut. Fine. See you at 7? Sure thing. They walked to the door together. Thank Lucy for the invite again, Stu said. Franny and I'll take her up on it before long. Okay. As Stu reached the door, Larry said, Hey. Stu turned back, questioning. There's a boy, Larry said slowly, that came across from Maine with us. His name is Leo Rockway. He's had his problems. Lucy and I sort of share him with a woman named Nadine Cross. Nadine's a little out of the ordinary herself, you know. Stu nodded. There had been some talk about a peculiar little scene between Mother Abigail and the Cross woman when Larry brought his party in. Nadine was taking care of Leo before I ran across him. Leo kind of sees into people. He's not the only one, either. Maybe there were always people like that, but there seems to be a little bit more of it around since the flu. And Leo, he wouldn't go into Harold's house. Wouldn't even stay on the lawn. That's sort of funny, isn't it? It is, Stu agreed. They looked at each other thoughtfully for a moment, and then Stu left to go home and get his supper. Fran seemed preoccupied herself during the meal and didn't talk much. And while she was still doing the last of the dishes in a plastic bucket full of warm water, people began arriving for the first meeting of the Free Zone Ad Hoc Committee. After Stu had gone over to Larry's, Franny rushed upstairs to the bedroom. In the corner of the closet was the sleeping bag she had carried across the country, strapped to the back of her motorcycle. She had kept her personal belongings in a small zipper bag. Most of those belongings were now distributed through the apartment she and Stu shared, but a few still hadn't found a home and rested at the foot of the sleeping bag. There were several bottles of cleansing cream. She had suffered a sudden rash of skin outbreaks after the deaths of her mother and father, but that had now subsided. A box of stay-free mini-pads in case she did start spotting. She had heard that pregnant women sometimes did. 2 boxes of cheap cigars, one marked, It's a Boy, and the other marked, It's a Girl. The last item was her diary. She drew it out and looked at it speculatively. She had entered in it only 8 or 9 times since their arrival in Boulder, although she intended to keep it more fully when things settled down a little. For the baby. The way people get when they convert to religion or read something that changes their lives, like intercepted love letters. Suddenly it seemed to her that the book had gained weight and that the very act of turning back the pasteboard cover would cause sweat to pop out on her brow and... She suddenly looked back over her shoulder, her heart beating wildly. Had something moved in here? A mouse, scuttering behind the wall, maybe. Surely no more than that. More likely just her imagination. There was no reason at all for her to suddenly be thinking of the man in the black robe, the man with the coat hanger, Her baby was alive and safe, and this was just a book. And anyhow, there was no way to tell if a book had been read. And even if there was a way, there would be no way to tell if the person who had read it had been Harold Lauder. Still, she opened the book and began to turn slowly through its pages, getting shutter clicks of the recent past like black-and-white photographs taken by an amateur. Home movies of the mind. Tonight we were admiring them, and Harold was going on about color and texture and tone, and Stu gave me a very sober wink. Evil me, I winked back. Harold will object on general principles, of course. Damn you, Harold, grow up. And I could see him getting ready with one of his patented Harold Lauder smart-ass comments. My God, Fran, why did you ever say all those things about him? To what purpose? Well, you know Harold, his swagger, all those pompous words and pronouncements, an insecure little boy. That was July 12th. Wincing, she turned past it rapidly, fluttering through the pages now, in a hurry to get to the end. Phrases still leaped up, seeming to slap at her. Anyway, Harold smelled pretty clean for a change. Harold's breath would have driven away a dragon tonight. And another, seeming almost prophetic. He stores up rebuffs like pirate treasure. But to what purpose? To feed his own feelings of secret superiority and persecution? Or was it a matter of retribution? Oh, he's making a list and checking it twice. Then, on August 1st, only 2 weeks ago, the entry started at the bottom of a page. No entry last night. I was too happy. Have I ever been this happy? I don't think so. Stu and I are together. We... End of the page. She turned to the next one. The first words at the top of the page were, "Made love twice." But they barely caught her eye before her glance dropped halfway down the page. There, beside some blathering about the maternal instinct, was something that caught her eyes and froze her almost solid. It was a large, smeary thumbprint. She thought wildly, "I was riding on a motorcycle all day long, every day. Sure, I took care to clean up every chance I got, but your hands get dirty and..." She put out her hand, not at all surprised to see that it was shaking badly. She put her thumb on the smudge. The smudge was a lot bigger. And it wasn't grease or oil. There was no use even kidding herself that it was. It was dried chocolate. Paydays, Franny thought sickly. For a moment she was afraid to do so much as turn around. Afraid that she might see Harold's grin hanging over her shoulder like the grin of the Cheshire Cat in Alice. Harold's thick lips moving as he said solemnly, "Every dog has his day, Franny. Every dog has his day." But even if Harold had sneaked a glance into her diary, did it have to mean he was contemplating some secret vendetta against her or Stu or any of the others? Of course not. "But Harold's changed," an interior voice whispered. "God damn it, he hasn't changed that much," she cried to the empty room. She flinched a little at the sound of her own voice, then laughed shakily. She went downstairs and began to get supper. They would be eating early because of the meeting. But suddenly, the meeting didn't seem as important as it had earlier. Excerpts from the minutes of the ad hoc committee meeting, August 13th, 1980. The meeting was held in the apartment of Stu Redman and Francis Goldsmith. All members of the ad hoc committee were present, those being Stuart Redman, Francis Goldsmith, Nick Andros, Glenn Bateman, Ralph Brentner, Susan Stern, and Larry Underwood. Stu Redman was elected moderator of the meeting. Francis Goldsmith was elected recording secretary. These notes, plus complete coverage of every burp, gurgle, and aside, all recorded on Memorex cassettes for anyone crazy enough to want to listen to them, will be placed in a safe deposit box of the First Bank of Boulder. Stu Redman presented a broadside on the subject of food poisoning, written by Dick Ellis and Laurie Constable, eye-catchingly titled, "If You Eat, You Should Read This." He said Dick wanted to see it printed and nailed up all over Boulder before the big meeting on August 18th, because there have already been 15 cases of food poisoning in Boulder, two of them quite serious. The committee voted 7-0 that Ralph should duplicate 1,000 copies of Dick's poster and get 10 people to help him put them up all over town. Susan Stern then presented another item that Dick and Lori wanted to put before the meeting. We all wished one or the other of them could have been here. They both feel that there must be a burial committee. Dick's idea was that it should be put on the agenda of the public meeting and that it be presented not as a health hazard, because of the possibility it might cause panic, but as the decent thing to do. We all know there are surprisingly few corpses in Boulder in proportion to its pre-plague population, but we don't know why, not that it matters much now. But there are still thousands of dead bodies, and they must be gotten rid of if we intend to stay here. Stu asked how serious the problem was at present, and Sue said she thought it would not become really serious until fall, when the dry, hot weather usually turns damp. Larry Underwood made a motion that we add Dick's suggestion that a burial committee be formed to the agenda of the August 18th meeting. The motion was carried 7-0. Nick Andros was then recognized, and Ralph Brentner read his prepared comments, which I am here quoting verbatim. One of the most important questions this committee must deal with is whether or not it will agree to take Mother Abigail into its complete confidence, and shall she be told about everything that goes on at our meetings, both open and closed? The question can also be put the other way. Shall Mother Abigail agree to take this committee, and the permanent committee that will follow it, into her complete confidence, and shall the committee be told about all that goes on in her meetings with God or whoever, particularly the closed ones? That may sound like gibberish, but let me explain, because it's really a pragmatic question. We have to settle Mother Abigail's place in the community right away, because our problem is not just one of getting on our feet again. If that was all, we wouldn't really need her in the first place. As we all know, there is another problem, that of the man we sometimes call the dark man, or as Glenn puts it, the adversary. My proof for his existence is very simple, and I think most people in Boulder will agree with my reasoning, if they wanted to think of it at all. Here it is. I dreamed of Mother Abigail, and she was. I dreamed of the dark man, and therefore he must be, although I have never seen him. The people here love Mother Abigail, and I love her myself. But we won't get far, in fact, we won't get anywhere, if we don't start off with her approval of what we're doing. So this early afternoon I went to see the lady and put the question to her directly, with all the bark on it. Will you go along? She said that she would, but not without conditions. She was perfectly blunt. She said we should be perfectly free to guide the community in all worldly matters, her phrase, clearing the streets, allocating housing, getting the power back on. But she was also very clear about wanting to be consulted on all matters that have to do with the dark man. She believes we are all a part of a chess game between God and Satan, that Satan's chief agent in this game is the adversary, whose name, she says, is Randall Flagg. The name he's using this time is how she puts it. That for reasons best known to himself, God has chosen her as his agent in this matter. She believes, and in this I happen to agree with her, that a struggle is coming, and it's going to be us or him. She thinks this struggle is the most important thing, and she's adamant about being consulted. Now, I don't want to get into the religious implications of all this, or argue whether she's right or wrong, but it should be obvious that all implications aside, we have a situation we must cope with. So I have a series of motions. There was some discussion of Nick's statement. Nick made this motion. Can we as a committee agree not to discuss the theological, religious, or supernatural implications of the adversary matter during our meetings? By a 7-0 vote, the committee agreed to bar discussion on those matters, at least while we are in session. Nick then made this motion. Can we agree that the main private secret business of the committee is the question of how to deal with this force known as the dark man, the adversary, or Randall Flagg? Glenn Bateman seconded the motion, adding that from time to time there might be other business, such as the real reason for the burial committee, that we should keep close to the vest. The motion carried 7-0. Nick then made his original motion that we keep Mother Abigail informed of all public and private business transacted by the committee. That motion was also passed 7-0. Having disposed of the Mother Abigail business for the time being, the committee then moved on to the question of the dark man himself at Nick's request. He proposed that we send 3 volunteers west to join the dark man's people, the purpose being to gain intelligence about what's really going on over there. Sue Stern immediately volunteered. After some hot discussion of that, Glenn Bateman was recognized by Stu and put this motion on the floor. Resolved that no one from our ad hoc committee or from the permanent committee be eligible to volunteer for this reconnaissance. Sue Stern wanted to know why not. Glenn. Everyone respects your honest desire to help, Susan, but the fact is we simply don't know if the people we send will ever come back, or when, or in what shape. In the meantime, we have the not-so-inconsiderable job of getting things in Boulder on a paying basis, if you'll pardon the slang. If you go, we'll have to fill your seat with someone who would have to be briefed on the ground we've already covered. I just don't think we can afford all that lost time. With some reluctance, Sue went along with Glenn's motion, which was carried, gloomily, by a 7-0 vote. Fran Goldsmith then asked Nick what sort of qualifications we should look for in prospective undercover agents, and what we should expect them to find out. Nick. We won't know what there is to be learned until they come back, if they do come back. The point is, we have absolutely no idea what he's up to over there. We're more or less like fishermen using human bait. Stu said he thought the committee should pick the people it wanted to ask, and there was general agreement on this. The nominations of our 3 potential spies occupied the rest of the committee's time. Coming to bed, Stu?
Yeah. Is it late?
Almost midnight. Late enough. Stu came in from the balcony. He was wearing jockey shorts and nothing else. Their whiteness was nearly dazzling against his tanned skin. She found herself amazed again by the confident depth of her love for him. Thinking about the meeting? She asked him.
Yes, I was.
He poured himself a glass of water from the pitcher on the night table and grimaced at the flat, boiled taste. I thought you made a wonderful moderator. Glenn asked if you'd do it at the public meeting, didn't he? Is it bothering you? Did you decline?
No, I said I would. I guess I can do that.
I was thinking about sending those 3 across the mountains. It's a dirty business, sending out spies.
You were right, Franny. Only trouble is, Nick was right, too. In a case like that, what you going to do?
Vote your conscience and then get the best night's sleep you can, I guess.
She reached out to touch the Coleman lamp switch.
Ready for the light?
Yeah.
She put it out and he swung into bed beside her.
Good night, Franny, he said. I love you.
She lay looking at the ceiling. The smudged chocolate thumbprint stayed on her mind.
Every dog has its day, Fran.
Maybe I ought to tell Stu right now, she thought. But if there was a problem, it was her problem. She would just have to wait,
watch, and see if anything happened.
It was a long time before she slept.